Preface of the Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Graham Redman. The Wars of the Jews by Josephus, translated by William Whiston. Preface. Footnote. I have already observed more than once that this history of the Jewish war was Josephus's first work, and published about AD 75, when he was but 38 years of age, and that when he wrote it, he was not thoroughly acquainted with several circumstances of history from the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, with which it begins, till near his own times, contained in the first and former part of the second book, and so committed many involuntary errors therein. That he published his Antiquities 18 years afterward, in the 13th year of Domitian, AD 93, when he was much more completely acquainted with those ancient times, and after he had perused those most authentic histories, the first book of Maccabees, and the chronicles of the priesthood of John Hyrcanus, etc. That accordingly he then reviewed those parts of this work, and gave the public a more faithful, complete, and accurate account of the facts therein related, and honestly corrected the errors he had before run into. End of footnote. Whereas the war which the Jews made with the Romans hath been the greatest of all those, not only that have been in our times, but in a manner of those that ever were heard of, both of those wherein cities have fought against cities, or nations against nations, while some men who were not concerned in the affairs themselves have gotten together vain and contradictory stories by hearsay, and have written them down after a sophistical manner, and while those that were there present have given false accounts of things, and this either out of a humour of flattery to the Romans, or of hatred towards the Jews, and while their writings contain sometimes accusations, and sometimes encomiums, but nowhere the accurate truth of the facts, I have proposed to myself, for the sake of such as live under the government of the Romans, to translate those books into the Greek tongue, which I formerly composed in the language of our country, and sent to the upper barbarians. Footnote. Who these upper barbarians, remote from the sea, were, Josephus himself will inform us in section 2, namely the Parthians and Babylonians, and remotest Arabians of the Jews among them, besides the Jews beyond Euphrates, and the Adiabeni or Assyrians. Whence we also learn that these Parthians, Babylonians, the remotest Arabians, or at least the Jews among them, as also the Jews beyond Euphrates and the Adiabeni or Assyrians, understood Josephus's Hebrew, or rather Chaldaic, books of the Jewish war, before they were put into the Greek language. End of footnote. Joseph, the son of Matthias, by birth a Hebrew, a priest also, and one who at first fought against the Romans myself, and was forced to be present at what was done afterwards, am the author of this work. Now at the time when this great concussion of affairs happened, the affairs of the Romans were themselves in great disorder. Those Jews also who were for innovations then arose when the times were disturbed. They were also in a flourishing condition for strength and riches, insomuch that the affairs of the East were then exceeding tumultuous, while some hoped for gain, and others were afraid of loss in such troubles. For the Jews hoped that all of their nation, which were beyond Euphrates, would have raised an insurrection together with them. The Gauls also, in the neighbourhood of the Romans, were in motion, and the Geltin were not quiet, but all was in disorder after the death of Nero. And the opportunity now offered induced many to aim at the royal power, and the soldiery affected change out of the hopes of getting money. I thought it, therefore, an absurd thing to see the truth falsified in affairs of such great consequence, and to take no notice of it, but to suffer those Greeks and Romans that were not in the wars to be ignorant of these things, and to read either flatteries or fictions, while the Parthians and the Babylonians and the remotest Arabians and those of our nation beyond Euphrates with the Adiabeni by my means knew accurately both whence the war begun, what miseries it brought upon us, and after what manner it ended. It is true these writers have the confidence to call their accounts histories, wherein yet they seem to me to fail of their own purpose, as well as to relate nothing that is sound. For they have a mind to demonstrate the greatness of the Romans, while they still diminish and lessen the actions of the Jews, as not discerning how it cannot be that those must appear to be great who have only conquered those that were little. Nor are they ashamed to overlook the length of the war, the multitude of the Roman forces who so greatly suffered in it, or the might of the commanders, whose great labours about Jerusalem will be deemed inglorious, if what they achieved be reckoned but a small matter. However, I will not go to the other extreme, out of opposition to those men who extol the Romans, nor will I determine to raise the actions of my countrymen too high, but I will prosecute the actions of both parties with accuracy. Yet shall I suit my language to the passions I am under, as to the affairs I describe, and must be allowed to indulge some lamentations upon the miseries undergone by my own country. For that it was a seditious temper of our own that destroyed it, and that they were the tyrants among the Jews who brought the Roman power upon us, who unwillingly attacked us and occasioned the burning of our holy temple, Titus Caesar, who destroyed it, is himself a witness, who during the entire war pitied the people who were kept under by the seditious, and did often voluntarily delay the taking of the city, and allowed time to the siege, in order to let the authors have opportunity for repentance. But if any one makes an unjust accusation against us when we speak so passionately about the tyrants or the robbers, or sorely bewail the misfortunes of our country, let him indulge my affections herein, though it be contrary to the rules for writing history, because it had so come to pass that our city Jerusalem had arrived at a higher degree of felicity than any other city under the Roman government, and yet at last fell into the sorest of calamities again. Accordingly, it appears to me that the misfortunes of all men from the beginning of the world, if they be compared to these of the Jews, footnote, that these calamities of the Jews, who were our Saviour's murderers, were to be the greatest that had ever been since the beginning of the world, our Saviour had directly foretold. Matthew chapter 24, verse 21, Mark chapter 13, verse 19, Luke chapter 21, verses 23 and 24. And that they proved to be such accordingly, Josephus is here a most authentic witness. End of footnote. Are not so considerable as they were, while the authors of them were not foreigners neither. This makes it impossible for me to contain my lamentations, but if any one be inflexible in his censures of me, let him attribute the facts themselves to the historical part, and the lamentations to the writer himself only. However, I may justly blame the learned men among the Greeks, who, when such great actions have been done in their own times, which, upon the comparison, quite eclipse the old wars, do yet sit as judges of those affairs, and pass bitter censures upon the labours of the best writers of antiquity, which moderns, although they may be superior to the old writers in eloquence, yet are they inferior to them in the execution of what they intended to do. While these also write new histories about the Assyrians and Medes, as if the ancient writers had not described their affairs as they ought to have done, although these be as far inferior to them in abilities as they are different in their notions from them. For of old every one took upon them to write what happened in his own time, where their immediate concern in the actions made their promises of value, and where it must be reproachful to write lies, when they must be known by the readers to be such. But then, an undertaking to preserve the memory of what hath not been before recorded, and to represent the affairs of one's own time to those that come afterwards, is really worthy of praise and commendation. Now he is to be esteemed to have taken good pains in earnest, not who does no more than change the disposition and order of other men's works, but he who not only relates what had not been related before, but composes an entire body of history of his own. Accordingly, I have been at great charges, and have taken very great pains about this history, though I be a foreigner, and do dedicate this work as a memorial of great actions, both to the Greeks and to the barbarians. But for some of our own principal men, their mouths are wide open, and their tongues loosed presently, for gain and lawsuits, but quite muzzled up when they are to write history, where they must speak truth, and gather facts together with a great deal of pains. And so they leave the writing such histories to weaker people, and to such as are not acquainted with the actions of princes. Yet shall the real truth of historical facts be preferred by us, how much soever it be neglected among the Greek historians. To write concerning the antiquities of the Jews, who they were originally, and how they revolted from the Egyptians, and what country they travelled over, and what countries they seized upon afterward, and how they were removed out of them, I think this not to be a fit opportunity, and on other accounts also superfluous. And this because many Jews before me have composed the histories of our ancestors very exactly, as have some of the Greeks done it also, and have translated our histories into their own tongue, and have not much mistaken the truth in their histories. But then, where the writers of these affairs and our prophets leave off, thence shall I take my rise, and begin my history. Now, as to what concerns that war which happened in my own time, I will go over it very largely, and with all the diligence I am able. But for what preceded mine own age, that I shall run over briefly. For example, I shall relate how Antiochus, who was named Epiphanes, took Jerusalem by force, and held it 3 years and 3 months, and was then ejected out of the country by the sons of Asamoneus. After that, how their posterity quarrelled about the government, and brought upon their settlement the Romans and Pompey. How Herod also, the son of Antipater, dissolved their government, and brought Sosius upon them. As also how our people made a sedition upon Herod's death, while Augustus was the Roman emperor, and Quintilius Varus was in that country, and how the war broke out in the 12th year of Nero, with what happened to Cestius, and what places the Jews assaulted in a hostile manner in the first sallies of the war. As also I shall relate how they built walls about the neighbouring cities, and how Nero, upon Cestius's defeat, was in fear of the entire event of the war, and thereupon made Vespasian general in this war, and how this Vespasian, with the elder of his sons, [Footnote: Titus.] made an expedition into the country of Judea, what was the number of the Roman army that he made use of, and how many of his auxiliaries were cut off in all Galilee, and how he took some of its cities entirely and by force, and others of them by treaty and on terms. Now, when I am come so far, I shall describe the good order of the Romans in war, and the discipline of their legions, the amplitude of both the Galilees, with its nature and the limits of Judea. And besides this, I shall particularly go over what is peculiar to the country, the lakes and fountains that are in them, and what miseries happened to every city as they were taken. And all this with accuracy, as I saw the things done or suffered in them. For I shall not conceal any of the calamities I myself endured, since I shall relate them to such as know the truth of them. After this I shall relate how, when the Jews' affairs were become very bad, Nero died, and Vespasian, when he was going to attack Jerusalem, was called back to take the government upon him. What signs happened to him relating to his gaining that government, and what mutations of government then happened at Rome, and how he was unwillingly made emperor by his soldiers, and how, upon his departure to Egypt to take upon him the government of the empire, the affairs of the Jews became very tumultuous, as also how the tyrants rose up against them, and fell into dissensions among themselves. Moreover, I shall relate how Titus marched out of Egypt into Judea the second time, as also how and where and how many forces he got together, and in what state the city was by the means of the seditious at his coming, what attacks he made and how many ramparts he cast up, of the three walls that encompassed the city and of their measures, of the strength of the city and the structure of the temple and holy house, and besides the measures of those edifices and of the altar, and all accurately determined. A description also of certain of their festivals, and seven purifications of purity. Footnote: these seven, or rather five, degrees of purity or purification are enumerated hereafter. The rabbins make 10 degrees of them, as Reland there informs us. End of footnote. And the sacred ministrations of the priests, with the garments of the priests and of the high priests, and of the nature of the most holy place of the temple, without concealing anything or adding anything to the known truth of things. After this I shall relate the barbarity of the tyrants towards the people of their own nation, as well as the indulgence of the Romans in sparing foreigners, and how often Titus, out of his desire to preserve the city and the temple, invited the seditious to come to terms of accommodation. I shall also distinguish the sufferings of the people and their calamities, how far they were afflicted by the sedition, and how far by the famine, and at length were taken. Nor shall I omit to mention the misfortunes of the deserters, nor the punishments inflicted on the captives, as also how the temple was burnt against the consent of Caesar, and how many sacred things that had been laid up in the temple were snatched out of the fire, the destruction also of the entire city, with the signs and wonders that went before it, and the taking the tyrants captives, and the multitude of those that were made slaves, and into what different misfortunes they were every one distributed. Moreover, what the Romans did to the remains of the wall, and how they demolished the strongholds that were in the country, and how Titus went over the whole country and settled its affairs, together with his return into Italy and his triumph. I have comprehended all these things in 7 books, and have left no occasion for complaint or accusation to such as have been acquainted with this war. And I have written it down for the sake of those that love truth, but not for those that please themselves with fictitious relations. And I will begin my account of these things with what I call my first chapter. End of preface. Recording by Graham Redman.
Book 1, Chapters 11 and 12 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Morgan Scorpion. The Wars of the Jews by Josephus. Translated by William Whiston. Book 1, Chapters 11 and 12. Chapter 11. Herod is made procurator of all Syria. Malichus is afraid of him, and takes Antipater off by poison, whereupon the tribunes of the soldiers are prevailed with to kill him. 1. There was at this time a mighty war raised among the Romans upon the sudden and treacherous slaughter of Caesar by Cassius and Brutus, after he had held the government for 3 years and 7 months. Footnote. In the Antiquities, the duration of the reign of Julius Caesar is 3 years, 6 months, but here, 3 years, 7 months, beginning nightly, says Dean Aldrich, from his second dictatorship. It is probable the real duration might be 3 years and between 6 and 7 months. End footnote. Upon this murder there were very great agitations, and the great men were mightily at difference one with another, and every one betook himself to that party where they had the greatest hopes of their own, of advancing themselves. Accordingly, Cassius came into Syria, in order to receive the forces that were at Apamea, where he procured a reconciliation between Bassus and Marcus, and the legions which were at difference with him. So he raised the siege of Apamea, and took upon him the command of the army, and went about exacting tribute of the cities, and demanding their money to such a degree as they were not able to bear. 2. So he gave command that the Jews should bring in 700 talents, whereupon Antipater, out of his dread of Cassius's threats, parted the raising of the sum among his sons, and among others of his acquaintance, and to be done immediately. And among them he required one Malichus, who was at enmity with him, to do his part also, which necessity forced him to do. Now Herod, in the first place, mitigated the passion of Cassius by bringing his share out of Galilee, which was 100 talents, on which account he was in the highest favour with him. And when he reproached the rest for being tardy, he was angry at the cities themselves. So he made slaves of Gophna and Emmaus, and 2 others of less note. Nay, he proceeded as if he would kill Malichus, because he had not made greater haste in exacting his tribute. But Antipater prevented the ruin of this man, and of the other cities, and got into Cassius's favour by bringing in 100 talents immediately. Footnote. It appears evidently by Josephus's accounts, both here and in his Antiquities, that this Cassius, one of Caesar's murderers, was a bitter oppressor and exactor of tribute in Judea. These 700 talents amount to about £300,000 sterling, and are about half the yearly revenues of King Herod afterwards. It also appears that Galilee then paid no more than 100 talents, or the 1/7 part of the entire sum to be levied in all the country. End footnote. 3. However, when Cassius was gone, Malichus forgot the kindness that Antipater had done him, and laid frequent plots against him that had saved him, as making haste to get him out of the way, who was an obstacle to his wicked practices. But Antipater was so much afraid of the power and cunning of the man, that he went beyond Jordan, in order to get an army to guard himself against his treacherous designs. But when Malichus was caught in his plot, he put upon Antipater's sons by his impudence, for he thoroughly deluded Phasaelus, who was the guardian of Jerusalem, and Herod, who was entrusted with the weapons of war, and this by a great many excuses and oaths, and persuaded them to procure his reconciliation to his father. Thus he was preserved again by Antipater, who dissuaded Marcus, the then president of Syria, from his resolution of killing Malichus, on account of his attempts for innovation. 4. Upon the war between Cassius and Brutus on one side, against the young Caesar, Augustus, and Antony on the other, Cassius and Marcus got together an army out of Syria. And because Herod was likely to have a great share in providing necessaries, they then made him procurator of all Syria, and gave him an army of foot and horse. Cassius promised him also that after the war was over, he would make him king of Judea. But it so happened that the power and hopes of his son became the cause of his perdition, for as Malichus was afraid of this, he corrupted one of the king's cupbearers with money to give a poisoned potion to Antipater. So he became a sacrifice to Malichus's wickedness and died at a feast. He was a man in other respects active in the management of affairs, and one that recovered the government to Hyrcanus and preserved it in his hands. However, Malichus, when he was suspected of poisoning Antipater, and when the multitude was angry with him for it, denied it, and made the people believe he was not guilty. He also prepared to make a greater figure, and raised soldiers, for he did not suppose that Herod would be quiet, who indeed came upon him with an army presently, in order to avenge his father's death. But upon hearing the advice of his brother Pharsalius, not to punish him in an open manner, lest the multitude should fall into a sedition, he admitted of Malichus's apology, and professed that he cleared him of that suspicion. He also made a pompous funeral for his father. So Herod went to Samaria, which was then in a tumult, and settled the city in peace, after which, at the Pentecost festival, he returned to Jerusalem, having his armed men with him. Hereupon Hyrcanus, at the request of Malichus, who feared his reproach, forbade them to introduce foreigners to mix themselves with people of the country while they were purifying themselves. But Herod despised the pretense, and him that gave that command, and came in by night. Upon which Malichus came to him, and bewailed Antipater. Herod also made him believe, he admitted of his lamentations as real, although he had much ado to restrain his passion at him. However, he did himself bewail the murder of his father in his letters to Cassius, who on other accounts also hated Malichus. Cassius sent him word back that he should avenge his father's death upon him, and privately gave orders to the tribunes that were under him, that they should assist Herod in a righteous action he was about. 7. And because, upon the taking of Laodicea by Cassius, the men of power were gotten together from all quarters, with presents of crowns in their hands, Herod allotted this time for the punishment of Malichus. When Malichus suspected that, and was at Tyre, he resolved to withdraw his son privately from among the Tyrians, who was a hostage there, while he got ready to fly away into Judea. The despair he was in of escaping excited him to think of greater things, for he hoped that he should raise the nation to a revolt from the Romans, while Cassius was busy about the war against Antony, and that he should easily depose Hyrcanus and get the crown for himself. 8. But fate laughed at the hopes he had, for Herod foresaw what he was so zealous about, and invited both Hyrcanus and him to supper. But calling one of the principal servants that stood by him to him, he sent him out, as though it were to get things ready for supper, but in reality to give notice beforehand about the plot that was laid against him. Accordingly they called to mind what orders Cassius had given them, and went out of the city with their swords in their hands upon the seashore, where they encompassed Malichus round about, and killed him with many wounds. Upon which Hyrcanus was immediately affrighted, till he swooned away and fell down at the surprise he was in, and it was with difficulty that he was recovered. When he asked who it was that killed Malichus, and when one of the tribunes replied that it was done by the command of Cassius, "Then," said he, "Cassius has saved both me and my country, by cutting off one that was laying plots against them both." Whether he spake according to his own sentiments, or whether his fear was such that he was obliged to commend the action by saying so, is uncertain. However, by this method Herod inflicted punishment upon Malichus. Chapter 12. Phasaelus is too hard for Felix. Herod also overcomes Antigonus in battle. And the Jews accuse both Herod and Phasaelus, but Antonius acquits them, and makes them tetrarchs. 1. When Cassius was gone out of Syria, another sedition arose at Jerusalem, wherein Felix assaulted Phasaelus with an army. that he might revenge the death of Malichus upon Herod, by falling upon his brother. Now Herod happened then to be with Fabius, the governor of Damascus, and as he was going to his brother's assistance, he was detained by sickness. In the meantime, Phasaelus was by himself too hard for Felix, and reproached Hyrcanus on account of his ingratitude, both for what assistance he had afforded Malichus, and for overlooking Malichus's brother, when he possessed himself of the fortress. For he had gotten a great many of them already, and among them the strongest of them all, Masada. 2. However, nothing could be sufficient for him against the force of Herod, who, as soon as he was recovered, took the other fortresses again, and drove him out of Masada in the posture of a supplicant. He also drove away Marian, the tyrant of the Tyrians, out of Galilee, when he had already possessed himself of 3 fortified places. But as to those Tyrians whom he had caught, he preserved them all alive, nay, some of them he gave presents to, and so sent them away, and thereby procured good will to himself from the city, and hatred to the tyrant. Marian had indeed obtained that tyrannical power of Cassius, who set tyrants over all Syria. Footnote. Here we see that Cassius set tyrants over all Syria, so that his assisting to destroy Caesar does not seem to have proceeded from his true zeal for public liberty, but from a desire to be a tyrant himself. End footnote. And out of hatred to Herod it was that he assisted Antigonus, the son of Aristobulus, and principally on Fabius's account, whom Antigonus had made his assistant by money, and had him accordingly on his side when he made his descent. But it was Ptolemy, the kinsman of Antigonus, that supplied all that he wanted. 3. When Herod had fought against these in the avenues of Judea, he was conqueror in the battle, and drove away Antigonus, and returned to Jerusalem, beloved by everybody for the glorious action he had done. For those who did not before favour him did join themselves to him now, because of his marriage into the family of Hyrcanus. For as he had formerly married a wife out of his own country of no ignoble blood, who was called Doris, of whom he begat Antipater, so did he now marry Mariamne, the daughter of Alexander, the son of Aristobulus, and the granddaughter of Hyrcanus, and was become thereby a relation of the king. 4. But when Caesar and Antony had slain Cassius near Philippi, and Caesar was gone to Italy, and Antony to Asia, amongst the rest of the cities which sent ambassadors to Antony unto Bithynia, the great men of the Jews came also, and accused Phasaelus and Herod, that they kept the government by force, and that Hyrcanus had no more than an honourable name. Herod appeared ready to answer this accusation, and having made Antony his friend by the large sums of money which he gave him, he brought him to such a temper as not to hear the other speak against him, and thus did they part at this time. 5. However, after this, there came 100 of the principal men among the Jews to Daphne by Antioch to Antony, who was already in love with Cleopatra to the degree of slavery. These Jews put those men that were the most potent, both in dignity and eloquence, foremost, and accused the brethren. Footnote, Phasaelus and Herod, end footnote. But Messala opposed them and defended his brethren, and that while Hyrcanus stood by him, on account of his relation to them. When Antony had heard both sides, he asked Hyrcanus which party was the fittest to govern, who replied that Herod and his party were the fittest. Antony was glad of that answer, for he had been formerly treated in an hospitable and obliging manner by his father Antipater, when he marched into Judea with Gabinius. So he constituted the brethren tetrarchs, and committed to them the government of Judea. 6. But when the ambassadors had indignation at this procedure, Antony took 15 of them, and put them into custody, whom he was also going to kill presently, and the rest he drove away with disgrace, on which occasion a still greater tumult arose at Jerusalem. So they sent again 1,000 ambassadors to Tyre, where Antony now abode, as he was marching to Jerusalem. Upon those men who made a clamour he sent out the governor of Tyre, and ordered him to punish all that he could catch of them, and to settle those in the administration whom he had made tetrarchs. 7. But before this, Herod and Hyrcanus went out upon the seashore, and earnestly desired of these ambassadors that they would neither bring ruin upon themselves, nor war upon their native country, by their rash contentions. And when they grew still more outrageous, Antony sent out armed men, and slew a great many, and wounded more of them. of whom those that were slain were buried by Hyrcanus, as were the wounded put under the care of physicians by him. Yet would not those that had escaped be quiet still, but put the affairs of the city into such disorder, and so provoked Antony, that he slew those whom he had in bonds also. End of Book 1, Chapters 11 and 12. Book 1, Chapters 13 and 14 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Morgan Scorpion. The Wars of the Jews by Josephus. Translated by William Whiston. Book 1, Chapters 13 and 14. Chapter 13. The Parthians bring Antigonus back into Judea, and cast Hyrcanus and Phasaelus into prison. The flight of Herod, and the taking of Jerusalem, and what Hyrcanus and Phasaelus suffered. 1. Now 2 years afterward, when Barzaphanes, a governor amongst the Parthians, and Peorus, the king's son, had possessed themselves of Syria, and when Lysanias had already succeeded upon the death of his father Ptolemy, the son of Menaeus, in the government of Chalcis, he prevailed with the governor, by a promise of 1,000 talents and 500 women, to bring back Antigonus to his kingdom and to turn Hyrcanus out of it. Pacorus was by these means induced so to do, and marched along the sea coast, while he ordered Barzaphanes to fall upon the Jews as he went along the Mediterranean part of the country. But of the maritime people, the Tyrians would not receive Pacorus, although those of Ptolemais and Sidon had received him. So he committed a troop of his horse to a certain cupbearer belonging to the royal family, of his own name, Pacorus, and gave him orders to march into Judea, in order to learn the state of affairs among their enemies, and to help Antigonus when he should want their assistance. 2. Now as these men were ravaging Carmel, many of the Jews ran together to Antigonus, and showed themselves ready to make an incursion into the country. So he sent them before into that place called Drymus, the woodland. Footnote. This large and noted wood, or woodland, belonging to Carmel, called Apago by the Septuagint, is mentioned in the Old Testament, 2 Kings 19:23, Isaiah 37 and 24, and by I. Strabo, as both Aldrich and Spanheim here remark very pertinently. End footnote. To seize upon the place, whereupon a battle was fought between them, and they drove the enemy away, and pursued them, and ran after them as far as Jerusalem, and as their numbers increased, they proceeded as far as the king's palace. But as Hyrcanus and Phasaelus received them with a strong body of men, there happened a battle in the marketplace, in which Herod's party beat the enemy, and shut them up in the temple, and set 60 men in the houses adjoining as a guard to them. But the people that were tumultuous against the brethren came in, and burnt those men, while Herod, in his rage for killing them, attacked and slew many of the people, till one party made incursions on the other by turns, day by day, in the way of ambushes, and slaughters were made continually among them. 3. Now when that festival which we call Pentecost was at hand, all the places about the temple, and the whole city, was full of a multitude of people that were come out of the country, and which were the greatest part of them armed also, at which time Phasaelus guarded the wall, and Herod, with a few, guarded the royal palace. And when he made an assault upon his enemies, as they were out of their ranks, on the north quarter of the city, he slew a very great number of them, and put them all to flight. And some of them he shut up within the city, and others within the outward rampart. In the meantime, Antigonus desired that Pacorus might be admitted to be a reconciler between them, and Phasaelus was prevailed upon to admit the Parthian into the city with 500 horse, and to treat him in an hospitable manner, who pretended that he came to quell the tumult, but in reality he came to assist Antigonus. However, he laid a plot for Phasaelus, and persuaded him to go as an ambassador to Barzaphanes, in order to put an end to the war, although Herod was very earnest with him to the contrary, and exhorted him to kill the plotter, but not to expose himself to the snares he had laid for him, because the barbarians are naturally perfidious. However, Pacorus went out and took Hyrcanus with him, that he might be the less suspected. He also left some of the horsemen, called the freemen, with Herod, and conducted Phasaelus with the rest. Footnote. These accounts, that the Parthians fought chiefly on horseback, and that only some few of their soldiers were free men, perfectly agree with Trogus Pompeius, as Dean Aldrich well observes on this place. End footnote. 4. But now, when they were come to Galilee, they found that the people of that country had revolted, and were in arms, who came very cunningly to their leader, and besought him to conceal his treacherous intentions by an obliging behaviour to them. Accordingly, he at first made them presents, and afterward, as they went away, laid ambushes for them. And when they were come to one of the maritime cities called Ecdippon, they perceived that a plot was laid for them, for they were there informed of the promise of 1,000 talents, and how Antigonus had devoted the greatest number of the women that were with them, among the 500, to the Parthians. They also perceived that an ambush was always laid for them by the barbarians in the night time. They had also been seized on before this, unless they had waited for the seizure of Herod first at Jerusalem, because if he were once informed of this treachery of theirs, he would take care of himself. Nor was this a mere report, but they saw the guards already not far off them. 5. Nor would Phasaelus think of forsaking Hyrcanus and flying away, though Ophelius earnestly persuaded him to it. For this man had learned the whole scheme of the plot from Saramalla, the richest of all the Syrians. But Phasaelus went up to the Parthian governor, and reproached him to his face for laying this treacherous plot against them, and chiefly because he had done it for money. And he promised him that he would give him more money for their preservation than Antigonus had promised to give for the kingdom. But the sly Parthian endeavoured to remove all this suspicion by apologies and by oaths, and then went to the other Pacorus. Immediately after which those Parthians who were left, and had it in charge, seized upon Phasaelus and Hyrcanus, who could do no more than curse their perfidiousness and their perjury. 6. In the meantime the cupbearer was sent back, and laid a plot how to seize upon Herod, by deluding him, and getting him out of the city, as he was commanded to do. But Herod suspected the barbarians from the beginning, and having then received intelligence that a messenger, who was bringing him the letters that informed him of the treachery intended, had fallen among the enemy, he would not go out of the city, though Pacorus said very positive that he ought to go out, and meet the messengers that had brought the letters, for that the enemy had not taken them, and that the contents of them were not accounts of any plots upon them, but of what Phasaelus had done. Yet had he heard from another that his brother was seized, and Alexandra, footnote, Mariamne here, in the copies, end footnote, the shrewdest woman in the world, Hyrcanus's daughter, begged of him that he would not go out, nor trust himself to those barbarians, who now were come to make an attempt upon him openly. 7. Now as Pacorus and his friends were considering how they might bring their plot to bear privately, because it was not possible to circumvent a man of so great prudence by openly attacking him, Herod prevented them, and went off with the persons that were the most nearly related to him by night, and this without their enemies being apprised of it. But as soon as the Parthians perceived it, they pursued after them, and as he gave orders for his mother and sister and the young woman who was betrothed to him, with her mother and his youngest brother, to make the best of their way, he himself, with his servants, took all the care they could to keep off the barbarians, and when at every assault he had slain a great many of them, he came to the stronghold of Masada. 8. Nay, he found by experience that the Jews fell more heavily upon him than did the Parthians, and created him troubles perpetually, and this ever since he was gotten 60 furlongs from the city. These sometimes brought it to a sort of regular battle. Now in the place where Herod beat them, and killed a great number of them, there he afterward built a citadel, in memory of the great actions he did there, and adorned it with the most costly palaces, and erected very strong fortifications, and called it, from his own name, Herodium. Now as they were in their flight, many joined themselves to him every day, and at a place called Thresa of Idumea his brother Joseph met him, and advised him to ease himself of a great number of his followers, because Masada would not contain so great a multitude, which were above 9,000. Herod complied with this advice, and sent away the most cumbersome part of his retinue, that they might go into Idumea and give them provisions for their journey. But he got safe to the fortress with his nearest relations, and retained with him only the stoutest of his followers. And there it was that he left 800 of his men as a guard for the women, and provisions sufficient for a siege. But he made haste himself to Petra of Arabia. 9. As for the Parthians in Jerusalem, they betook themselves to plundering, and fell upon the houses of those that were fled, and upon the king's palace, and spared nothing but Hyrcanus's money, which was not above 300 talents. They lighted on other men's money also, but not so much as they hoped for Herod, having a long while had a suspicion of the perfidiousness of the barbarians, had taken care to have what was most splendid among his treasures conveyed to Idumea, as every one belonging to him had in like manner done also. But the Parthians proceeded to that degree of injustice, as to fill the country with war without denouncing it, and to demolish the city of Marissa, and not only to set up Antigonus for king, but to deliver Phasaelus and Hyrcanus bound into his hands, in order to their being tormented by him. Antigonus himself also bit off Hyrcanus's ears with his own teeth, as he fell down upon his knees to him, so that he might never be able, upon any mutation of affairs, to take the high priesthood again, for the high priests that officiated were to be complete and without blemish. 10. However, he failed in his purpose of abusing Phasaelus by reason of his courage, for though he had neither had the command of his sword nor of his hands, he prevented all abuses by dashing his head against a stone. So he demonstrated himself to be Herod's own brother, and Hyrcanus a most degenerate relation, and died with great bravery, and made the end of his life agreeable to the actions of it. There is also another report about his end, viz., that he recovered of that stroke, and that a surgeon who was sent by Antigonus to heal him filled the wound with poisonous ingredients, and so killed him. Whichsoever of these deaths he came to, the beginning of it was glorious. It is also reported that before he expired he was informed by a certain poor woman how Herod had escaped out of their hands, and that he said thereupon, "I now die with comfort, since I leave behind me one alive who will avenge me of mine enemies." 11. This was the death of Phasaelus. But the Parthians, although they had failed of the women they chiefly desired, yet did they put the government of Jerusalem into the hands of Antigonus, and took away Hyrcanus, and bound him, and carried him to Parthia. Chapter 14. When Herod is rejected in Arabia, he makes haste to Rome, where Antony and Caesar joined their interest to make him king. 1. Now Herod did the more zealously pursue his journey into Arabia, as making haste to get money of the king, while his brother was yet alive, by which money alone it was that he hoped to prevail upon the covetous temper of the barbarians to spare Phasaelus. For he reasoned thus with himself, that if the Arabian king was too forgetful of his father's friendship with him, and was too covetous to make him a free gift, he would, however, borrow of him as much as might redeem his brother, and put into his hands, as a pledge, the son of him that was to be redeemed. Accordingly, he led his brother's son along with him, who was of the age of 7 years. Now he was ready to give 300 talents for his brother, and intended to desire the intercession of the Tyrians to get them accepted. However, fate had been too quick for his diligence, and since Phasaelus was dead, Herod's brotherly love was now in vain. Moreover, he was not able to find any lasting friendship among the Arabians, for their king, Malichus, sent to him immediately, and commanded him to return back out of his country, and used the name of the Parthians as a pretense for so doing, as though these had denounced to him by their ambassadors to cast Herod out of Arabia, while in reality they had a mind to keep back what they owed to Antipater, and not be obliged to make requitals to his sons for the free gifts the father had made them. He also took the impudent advice of those who, equally with himself, were willing to deprive Herod of what Antipater had deposited among them, and these men were the most potent of all whom he had in his kingdom. 2. So when Herod had found that the Arabians were his enemies, and this for those very reasons whence he hoped they would have been the most friendly, and had given them such an answer as his passion suggested, he returned back and went for Egypt. Now he lodged the first evening at one of the temples of that country, in order to meet with those whom he left behind. But on the next day word was brought to him, as he was going to Rhinocurura, that his brother was dead, and how he came by his death. And when he had lamented him as much as his present circumstances could bear, he soon laid aside such cares, and proceeded on his journey. But now, after some time, the king of Arabia repented of what he had done, and sent presently away messengers to call him back. Herod had prevented them, and was come to Pelusium, where he could not obtain a passage from those that lay with the fleet, so he besought their captains to let him go by them. Accordingly, out of the reverence they bore to the fame and dignity of the man, they conducted him to Alexandria, and when he came into the city he was received by Cleopatra with great splendour, who hoped he might be persuaded to be commander of her forces in the expedition she was now about. But he rejected the queen's solicitations, and being neither affrighted at the height of that storm which then happened, nor at the tumults that were now in Italy, he sailed for Rome. 3. But as he was in great peril about Pamphylia, and obliged to cast out of the greatest part of the ship's lading, he with difficulty got safe to Rhodes, a place which had been grievously harassed in the war with Cassius. He was there received by his friends Ptolemy and Sapinius, and although he was then in want of money, he fitted up a 3-decked ship of very great magnitude, wherein he and his friends sailed to Brundisium. [Footnote: This Brentesium, or Brundisium, has coins still preserved, on which is written, as Spanheim informs us. End footnote. And went thence to Rome with all speed, where he first of all went to Antony, on account of the friendship his father had with him, and laid before him the calamities of himself and his family, and that he had left his nearest relations besieged in a fortress, and had sailed to him through a storm, to make supplication to him for assistance. 4. Hereupon Antony was moved to compassion at the change that had been made in Herod's affairs, and this both upon his calling to mind how hospitably he had been treated by Antipater, but more especially on account of Herod's own virtue. So he then resolved to get him made king of the Jews, whom he had himself formerly made tetrarch. The contest also that he had with Antigonus was another inducement, and that of no less weight than the great regard he had for Herod, for he looked upon Antigonus as a seditious person, and an enemy of the Romans. And as for Caesar, Herod found him better prepared than Antony, as remembering very fresh the wars he had gone through together with his father, the hospitable treatment he had met with from him, and the entire good will he had shown to him, besides the activity which he saw in Herod himself. So he called the Senate together, wherein Messalus, and after him Atratinus, produced Herod before them, and gave a full account of the merits of his father, and his own goodwill to the Romans. At the same time they demonstrated that Antigonus was their enemy, not only because he soon quarrelled with them, but because he now overlooked the Romans, and took the government by means of the Parthians. These reasons greatly moved the Senate, at which juncture Antony came in, and told them that it was for their advantage in the Parthian war that Herod should be king, so they gave all their votes for it. And when the Senate was separated, Antony and Caesar went out with Herod between them, while the consul and the rest of the magistrates went before them in order to offer sacrifices, and to lay the decree in the capital. Antony also made a feast for Herod on the first day of his reign. End of Book 1, Chapters 13 and 14. Book 1, Chapters 15 and 16 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Morgan Scorpion. The Wars of the Jews by Josephus. Translated by William Whiston. Book 1, Chapters 15 and 16. Chapter 15. Antigonus besieges those that were in Masada, whom Herod frees from confinement when he came back from Rome, and presently marches to Jerusalem, where he finds Silo corrupted by bribes. Now during this time Antigonus besieged those that were in Masada, who had all other necessities in sufficient quantity, but were in want of water, on which account Joseph, Herod's brother, was disposed to run away to the Arabians, with 200 of his own friends. because he had heard that Malichus repented of his offences with regard to Herod, and he had been so quick as to have been gone out of the fortress already, unless, on that very night when he was going away, there had fallen a great deal of rain, insomuch that his reservoirs were full of water, and so he was under no necessity of running away. After which, therefore, they made an irruption upon Antigonus's party, and slew a great many of them, some in open battles, and some in private ambush. Nor had they always success in their attempts, for sometimes they were beaten and ran away. 2. In the meantime, Ventidius, the Roman general, was sent out of Syria to restrain the incursions of the Parthians, and after he had done that, he came into Judea, in pretense indeed to assist Joseph and his party, but in reality to get money of Antigonus. And when he had pitched his camp very near to Jerusalem, as soon as he had got money enough, he went away with the greatest part of his forces. Yet still did he leave Silo with some part of them, lest if he had taken them all away, his taking of bribes might have been too openly discovered. Now Antigonus hoped that the Parthians would come again to his assistance, and therefore cultivated a good understanding with Silo in the meantime, lest any interruption should be given to his hopes. 3. Now by this time Herod had sailed out of Italy, and was come to Ptolemais, and as soon as he had gotten together no small army of foreigners, and of his own countrymen, he marched through Galilee against Antigonus, wherein he was assisted by Ventidius and Silo, both whom Dellius, a person sent by Antony, footnote, this Dellius is famous, or rather infamous, in the history of Mark Antony, as Spanheim and Aldrich here note, from the coins, from Plutarch and Dio, end footnote, persuaded to bring Herod into his kingdom. Now Ventidius was at this time among the cities, and composing the disturbances which had happened by means of the Parthians, as was Silo in Judea corrupted by the bribes that Antigonus had given him. Yet was not Herod himself destitute of power, but the number of his forces increased every day as he went along, and all Galilee, with few exceptions, joined themselves to him. So he proposed himself to set about his most necessary enterprise, and that was Masada, in order to deliver his relations from the siege they endured. But still Joppa stood in his way, and hindered his going thither, for it was necessary to take that city first, which was in the enemy's hands, that when he should go to Jerusalem, no fortress might be left in the enemy's power behind him. Silo also willingly joined him, as having now a plausible occasion of drawing off his forces from Jerusalem, and when the Jews pursued him and pressed upon him in his retreat, Herod made all excursion upon them with a small body of his men, and soon put them to flight, and saved Silo when he was in distress. 4. After this Herod took Joppa, and then made haste to Masada to free his relations. Now as he was marching, many came in to him, induced by their friendship to his father, some by the reputation he had already gained himself, and some in order to repay the benefits they had received from them both. But still what engaged the greatest number on his side was the hopes from him when he should be established in his kingdom, so that he had gotten together already an army hard to be conquered. But Antigonus laid an ambush for him as he marched out, in which he did little or no harm to his enemies. However, he easily recovered his relations again that were in Masada, as well as the fortress Ressa, and then marched to Jerusalem, when the soldiers that were with Silo joined themselves to his own, as did many out of the city, from a dread of his power. 5. Now when he had pitched his camp on the west side of the city, the guards that were there shot their arrows and threw their darts at them, while others ran out in companies, and attacked those in the forefront. But Herod commanded proclamation to be made at the wall, that he was come for the good of the people and the preservation of the city, without any design to be revenged on his open enemies, but to grant oblivion to them, though they had been the most obstinate against him. Now the soldiers that were for Antigonus made a contrary clamour, and neither did permit anybody to hear that proclamation, nor to charge their party. So Antigonus gave orders to his forces to beat the enemy from the walls. Accordingly, they soon threw their darts at them from the towers, and put them to flight. 6. And here it was that Silo discovered he had taken bribes, for he set many of the soldiers to clamour about their want of necessaries, and to demand their pay, in order to buy themselves food, and to demand that he would lead them into places convenient for their winter quarters, because all the parts about the city were laid waste by the means of Antigonus's army, which had taken all things away. By this he moved the army, and attempted to get them off the siege. But Herod went to the captains that were under Silo, and to a great many of the soldiers, and begged of them not to leave him, who was sent thither by Caesar, and Antony, and the Senate, for that he would take care to have their wants supplied that very day. After the making of which entreaty, he went hastily into the country, and brought thither so great an abundance of necessaries, that he cut off all Silo's pretences. And in order to provide that for the following days they should not want supplies, he sent to the people that were about Samaria, which city had joined itself to him, to bring corn and wine and oil and cattle to Jericho. When Antigonus heard of this, he sent some of his party with orders to hinder, and lay ambushes for these collectors of corn. This command was obeyed, and a great multitude of armed men were gathered together about Jericho, and lay upon the mountains, to watch those that brought the provisions. Yet was Herod not idle, but took with him 10 cohorts, 5 of them were Romans, and 5 were Jewish cohorts, together with some mercenary troops intermixed among them, and besides those a few horsemen, and came to Jericho, and when he came he found the city deserted, but that there were 500 men with their wives and children, who had taken possession of the tops of the mountains. These he took and dismissed them, while the Romans fell upon the rest of the city and plundered it, having found the houses full of all sorts of good things. So the king left a garrison at Jericho, and came back, and sent the Roman army into those cities which were come over to him, to take their winter quarters there, viz. Into Judea, or Idumea, and Galilee, and Samaria. Antigonus also by bribes obtained of Silo to let a part of his army be received at Lydda, as a compliment to Antonius. Chapter 16. Herod takes Sepphoris and subdues the robbers that were in the caves. He after that avenges himself upon Machaerus, as upon an enemy of his, and goes to Antony as he was besieging Samosata. 1. So the Romans lived in plenty of all things, and rested from war. However, Herod did not lie at rest, but seized upon Idumea and kept it, with 2,000 footmen and 400 horsemen. And this he did by sending his brother Joseph thither, that no innovation might be made by Antigonus. He also removed his mother and all his relations who had been in Masada to Samaria, and when he had settled them securely, he marched to take the remaining parts of Galilee, and to drive away the garrisons placed there by Antigonus. 2. But when Herod had reached Sepphoris, footnote, this Sepphoris, the metropolis of Galilee, so often mentioned by Josephus, has coins still remaining, as Spanham here informs us. End footnote. In a very great snow, he took the city without any difficulty, the guards that should have kept it flying away before it was assaulted, where he gave an opportunity to his followers that had been in distress to refresh themselves, there being in that city a great abundance of necessaries. After which he hasted away to the robbers that were in the caves, who overran a great part of the country, and did as great mischief to its inhabitants as a war itself could have done. Accordingly, he sent beforehand 3 cohorts of footmen and 1 troop of horsemen to the village Arbela, and came himself 40 days afterwards with the rest of his forces. Footnote. This way of speaking, after 40 days, is interpreted by Josephus himself, on the 40th day. In like manner, when Josephus says, chapter 33, section 8, that Herod lived after he had ordered Antipater to be slain 5 days, this is by himself interpreted that he died on the 5th day afterwards. So also what is in this book, chapter 13, section 1, after 2 years is on the 2nd year, and Dean Aldrich here notes that this very way of speaking is familiar to Josephus. End footnote. Yet were not the enemy affrighted at his assault, but met him in arms, for their skill was that of warriors, but their boldness was the boldness of robbers. And therefore, when it came to a pitched battle, they put to flight Herod's left wing with their right one. But Herod, wheeling about on the sudden from his own right wing, came to their assistance, and both made his own left wing return back from its flight, and fell upon the pursuers, and cooled their courage, till they could not bear the attempts that were made directly upon them, and so turned back and ran away. 3. But Herod followed them, and slew them as he followed them, and destroyed a great part of them, till those that remained were scattered beyond the river Jordan, and Galilee was freed from the terrors they had been under, excepting from those that remained and lay concealed in caves, which required longer time ere they could be conquered. In order to which Herod, in the first place, distributed the fruits of their former labours to the soldiers, and gave every one of them 150 drachmae of silver, and a great deal more to their commanders, and sent them into their winter quarters. He also sent to his youngest brother Pheroas to take care of a good market for them, where they might buy themselves provisions, and to build a wall about Alexandrium, who took care of both those injunctions accordingly. 4. In the meantime, Antony abode at Athens, while Ventidius called for Silo and Herod to come to the war against the Parthians, but ordered them first to settle the affairs of Judea. So Herod willingly dismissed Silo to go to Ventidius, but he made an expedition himself against those that lay in the caves. Now these caves were in the precipices of craggy mountains, and could not be come at from any side, since they had only some winding pathways, very narrow, by which they got up to them. But the rock that lay on their front had beneath it valleys of a vast depth, and of an almost perpendicular declivity, insomuch that the king was doubtful for a long time what to do, by reason of a kind of impossibility there was of attacking the place. Yet did he at length make use of a contrivance that was subject to the utmost hazard, for he let down the most hardy of his men in chests, and set them at the mouths of the dens. Now these men slew the robbers and their families, and when they made resistance, they sent in fire upon them, and burnt them, and as Herod was desirous of saving some of them, he had proclamation made that they should come and deliver themselves up to him. But not one of them came willingly to him, and of those that were compelled to come, many preferred death to captivity. And here a certain old man, the father of 7 children, whose children, together with their mother, desired him to give them leave to go out, upon the assurance and right hand that was offered them, slew them after the following manner. He ordered every one of them to go out, and he stood himself at the cave's mouth, and slew that son of his perpetually who went out. Herod was near enough to see this sight, and his bowels of compassion were moved at it, and he stretched out his right hand to the old man, and besought him to spare his children. Yet did not he relent at all upon what he said, but over and above reproached Herod on the lowness of his descent, and slew his wife as well as his children. And when he had thrown their dead bodies down the precipice, he at last threw himself down after them. 5. By this means Herod subdued these caves, and the robbers that were in them. He then left there a part of his army, as many as he thought sufficient to prevent any sedition, and made Ptolemy their general, and returned to Samaria. He led also with him 3,000 armed footmen, and 600 horsemen against Antigonus. Now here those that used to raise tumults in Galilee, having liberty to do so upon his departure, fell unexpectedly upon Ptolemy, the general of his forces, and slew him. They also laid the country waste, and then retired to the bogs, and to places not easily to be found. But when Herod was informed of this insurrection, he came to the assistance of the country immediately, and destroyed a great number of the seditions, and raised the sieges of all the fortresses they had besieged. He also exacted the tribute of 100 talents of his enemies, as a penalty for the mutations they had made in the country. 6. By this time, the Parthians being already driven out of the country, and Pacorus slain, Ventidius, by Antony's command, sent 1,000 horsemen and 2 legions as auxiliaries to Herod, against Antigonus. Now Antigonus besought Machaerus, who was their general, by letter, to come to his assistance, and made a great many mournful complaints about Herod's violence, and about the injuries he did to the kingdom, and promised to give him money for such his assistance. But he complied not with his invitation to betray his trust, for he did not contemn them that sent him, especially while Herod gave him more money than the other offered. So he pretended friendship to Antigonus, but came as a spy to discover his affairs, although he did not herein comply with Herod, who dissuaded him from so doing. But Antigonus perceived what his intentions were beforehand, and excluded him out of the city, and defended himself against him as against an enemy, from the walls, till Machaerus was ashamed of what he had done, and retired to Emmaus to Herod. And as he was in a rage at his disappointment, he slew all the Jews whom he met with, without sparing those that were for Herod, but using them all as if they were for Antigonus. 7. Thereupon Herod was very angry at him, and was going to fight against Machaerus as his enemy, but he restrained his indignation, and marched to Antony to accuse Machaerus of maladministration. But Machaerus was made sensible of his offences, and followed after the king immediately, and earnestly begged and obtained that he would be reconciled to him. However, Herod did not desist from his resolution of going to Antony, but when he heard that he was besieging Samosata, [footnote: this Samosata, the metropolis of Commagena, is well known from its coins, as Spanheim here assures us. Dean Aldrich also confirms what Josephus here notes, that Herod was a great means of taking the city by Antony, and that from Plutarch and Dio, end footnote, with a great army, which is a strong city near to Euphrates, he made the greater haste, as observing that this was a proper opportunity for showing at once his courage, and for doing what would greatly oblige Antony. Indeed, when he came, he soon made an end of that siege, and slew a great number of the barbarians, and took from them a large prey, insomuch that Antony, who admired his courage formerly, did now admire it still more. Accordingly, he heaped many more honours upon him, and gave him more assured hopes that he should gain his kingdom. And now King Antiochus was forced to deliver up Samosata. End of Book 1, Chapters 15 and 16.
Book 1, Chapters 23 and 24 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Wars of the Jews by Josephus. Translated by William Whiston. Book 1, Chapters 23 and 24. Chapter 23. Calumnies against the sons of Mariamne. Antipaterus preferred before them. They are accused before Caesar, and Herod is reconciled to them. Now Mariamne's sons were heirs to that hatred which had been born their mother, and when they considered the greatness of Herod's crimes towards her, they were suspicious of him as an enemy of theirs, and this first while they were educated at Rome, but still more when they were returned to Judea. This temper of theirs increased upon them as they grew up to be men, and when they were come to an age fit for marriage, the one of them married their aunt Salome's daughter, which Salome had been the accuser of their mother. The other married the daughter of Archelaus, king of Cappadocia. And now they used boldness in speaking, as well as bore hatred in their minds. Now those that calumniated them took a handle from such their boldness, and certain of them spake now more plainly to the king that they were treacherous designs laid against him by both his sons, and that he was son-in-law to Archelaus, relying upon his father-in-law, was preparing to fly away, in order to accuse Herod before Caesar. And when Herod's head had been long enough filled with these calumnies, he brought Antipater, whom he had by Doris, into favor again, as a defense to him against his other sons, and began all the ways he possibly could to prefer him before them. But these sons were not able to bear this change in their affairs. But when they saw him that was born of a mother of no family, the nobility of their birth made them unable to contain their indignation. But whensoever they were uneasy, they showed the anger they had at it. And as these sons did day after day improve in their anger, Antipater already exercised all his own abilities, which were very great in flattering his father, and in contriving many sorts of calumnies against his brethren, while he told some stories of them himself, and put it upon other proper persons to raise other stories against them, till at length he entirely cut his brethren off from all hopes of succeeding to the kingdom, for he was already publicly put into his father's will as his successor. Accordingly he was sent with royal ornaments and other marks of royalty to Caesar, excepting the diadem. He was also able in time to introduce his mother again into Mariamne's bed. The two sorts of weapons he made use of against his brethren were flattery and calumny, whereby he brought matters privately to such a pass that the king had thoughts of putting his sons to death. So the father drew Alexander as far as Rome, and charged him with an attempt of poisoning him before Caesar. Alexander could hardly speak for lamentation, but having a judge that was more skillful than Antipater, and more wise than Herod, he modestly avoided laying any imputation upon his father, but with great strength of reason confuted the calumnies laid against him. And when he had demonstrated the innocency of his brother, who was in the like danger with himself, he at last bewailed the craftiness of Antipater, and the disgrace that they were under. He was enabled also to justify himself, not only by a clear conscience, which he carried with him, but by his eloquence, for he was a shrewd man in making speeches. And upon his saying at last that if his father objected this crime to them, it was in his power to put them to death, he made all the audience weep, and he brought Caesar to that pass as to reject the accusations and to reconcile their father to them immediately. But the conditions of this reconciliation were these, that they should in all things be obedient to their father, and that he should have power to leave the kingdom to which of them he pleased. After this the king came back from Rome, and seemed to have forgiven his sons upon these accusations, but still so that he was not without suspicions of them. They were followed by Antipater, who was the fountainhead of those accusations. Yet he did not openly discover his hatred to them, as revering him that they had reconciled them. But as Herod sailed by Cilicia, he touched at Eleusa, where Archelaus treated them in the most obliging manner, and gave him thanks for the deliverance of his son-in-law, and was much pleased at their reconciliation, and this the more, because he had formerly written to his friends at Rome that they should be assisting to Alexander at his trial. So he conducted Herod as far as Zephyrum, and made him presents to the value of 30 talents. Now when Herod was come to Jerusalem, he gathered the people together, and presented to them his 3 sons, and gave them an apologetic account of his absence, and thanked God greatly, and thanked Caesar greatly also, for settling his house when it was under disturbances, and had procured concord among his sons, which was of greater consequence than the kingdom itself. And which I will render still more firm, for Caesar hath put into my power to dispose of the government, and to appoint my successor. Accordingly, in the way of requital for his kindness, and in order to provide for mine own advantage, I do declare that these 3 sons of mine shall be kings. In the first place, I pray for the approbation of God to what I am about. And in the next place, I desire your approbation also. The age of one of them, and the nobility of the other 2, shall procure them the succession. Nay, indeed, my kingdom is so large that it may be sufficient for more kings. Now do you keep those in their places whom Caesar hath joined, and their father hath appointed. And do not you pay undue or unequal respects to them, but to every one according to the prerogative of their births. For he that pays such respects unduly will thereby not make him that is honored beyond what his age requires so joyfully, so as he will make him that is dishonored sorrowful. As for the kindred and friends that are to converse with them, I will appoint to each of them, and will so constitute them, so that they may be securities for their concord, as well knowing that the ill tempers of those with whom they converse will produce quarrels and contentions among them. But if these with whom they converse be of good tempers, they will preserve their natural affections for one another. But still I desire not these only, but all the captains of my army have for the present their hopes placed on me alone, for I do not give away my kingdom to these sons, but give them royal honors only, whereby it will come to pass that they will enjoy the sweet parts of government as rulers themselves, but that the burden of ministration will rest upon myself, whether I will or not. And let every one consider what age I am of, how I have conducted my life, what piety I have exercised, for my age is not so great that men may expect the end of my life, nor have I indulged such a luxurious way of living as cuts men off when they are young. And we have been so religious towards God that we, have reason to hope we, may arrive at a very great age. But for such as cultivate a friendship with my sons, or so to aim at my destruction, they shall be punished by me on their account. I am not one who envy my own children, and therefore forbid men to pay them great respect. But I know that such extravagant respects are the way to make them insolent. And if everyone that comes near them does but revolve this in his mind, that if he prove a good man, he shall receive a reward from me, but that if he prove seditious, his ill-intended complaisance shall get him nothing from him to whom it is shown. I suppose they will all be of my side, that is, of my son's side, for it will be for their advantage that I reign, and that I be at concord with them. But do you, O my good children, reflect upon the holiness of nature itself, by whose means natural affection is preserved, even among wild beasts. In the next place, reflect upon Caesar, who hath made this reconciliation amongst us. And in the third place, reflect upon me, who entreat you to do what I have power to command you. Continue, brethren. I give you royal garments and royal honors. I pray to God to preserve what I have determined, in case you be at concord with one another. When the king had thus spoken, and had saluted every one of his sons after an obliging manner, he dismissed the multitude, some of which gave their assent to what he had said, and wished it might take effect accordingly. But for those who wished a change of affairs, they pretended that they did not so much as hear what he had said. Chapter 24. The Malice of Antipater and Doris. Alexander is very uneasy on Glaphyrus' account. Herod pardons Pheroras, whom he suspected, and Salome, whom he knew to make mischief among them. Herod's eunuchs are tortured, and Alexander is bound. But now the quarrel which was between them still accompanied these brethren when they parted, and the suspicions that they had one of the other grew worse. Alexander and Aristobulus were much grieved that the privilege of the firstborn was confirmed to Antipater. So was Antipater very angry at his brethren that they were to succeed him. But then this last, being of a disposition that was mutable and politic, he knew how to hold his tongue, and used a great deal of cunning, and thereby concealed the hatred he bore to them, while the former, depending on the nobility of their births, had everything upon their tongues which was in their minds. Many also were those who provoked them further, and many of their seeming friends insinuated themselves into their acquaintance, to spy out what they did. Now everything that was said by Alexander was presently brought to Antipater, and from Antipater it was brought to Herod with additions. Nor could the young man say anything in the simplicity of his heart without giving offence, but what he said was still turned to calumny against him. And if he had been at any time a little free in his conversation, great imputations were forged from the smallest occasions. Antipater also was perpetually setting some to provoke him to speak, that the lies he raised of him might seem to have some foundation of truth. And if, among the many stories that were given out, but one of them could be proved true, that was supposed to imply the rest to be true also. And so, to Antipater's friends, they were all naturally so cautious in speaking, or had been so far bribed to conceal their thoughts, that nothing of these grand secrets got abroad by their means. Nor should one be mistaken if he calls the life of Antipater a mystery of wickedness, for he either corrupted Alexander's acquaintance with money, or got into their favor by flatteries, by which two means he gained all his designs, and brought them to betray their master, and to steal away, and to reveal what he either said or did. Thus did he act a part very cunningly in all points, and wrought himself a passage by his calumnies with the greatest shrewdness, while he put on a face as if he were a kind brother to Alexander and Aristobulus, but suborned other men to inform of what they did to Herod. And when anything was told against Alexander, he would come in and pretend to be of his side, and would begin to contradict what was said, but would afterwards contrive matters so privately that the king should have an indignation at him. His general aim was this, to lay a plot, and to make it believed that Alexander lay in wait to kill his father, for nothing afforded so great a confirmation to these calumnies as did Antipater's apologies for him. By these methods Herod was inflamed, and as much as his natural affection to the young men did every day diminish, so much did it increase towards Antipater. The courtiers also inclined to the same conduct, some of their own accord, and others by the king's injunction, as particularly did Ptolemy, the king's dearest friend, as also the king's brethren, and all his children. For Antipater was all in all. And what was the bitterest part of all to Alexander? Antipater's mother was also all in all. She was one that gave counsel against them, and was more harsh than a stepmother, and one that hated the queen's sons more than is usual to hate sons-in-law. All men did therefore already pay their respects to Alexander in hopes of advantage, and it was the king's command which alienated every body from the brethren. He, having given this charge to his most intimate friends, that they should not come near, nor pay any regard to Alexander or to his friends. Herod was also become terrible, not only to his domestics about the court, but to his friends abroad. For Caesar had given such a privilege to no other king as he had given to him, which was this, that he might fetch back any one that fled from him, even out of a city that was not under his own jurisdiction. Now the young men were not acquainted with the calumnies raised against them, for which reason they could not guard themselves against them, but fell under them, for their father did not make any public complaints against either of them, though in a little time they perceived how things were by his coldness towards them, and by the great uneasiness he showed upon anything that troubled him. Antipater had also made their uncle Pheroras to be their enemy, as well as their aunt Salome, while he was talking with her as with a wife, and irritating her against them. Moreover, Alexander's wife, Glaphyra, augmented this hatred against them, by deriving her nobility and genealogy from great persons, and pretending that she was a lady superior to all others in that kingdom, as being derived by her father's side from Temenus, and by her mother's side from Darius, the son of Hytaspes. She also frequently reproached Herod's sister and wives with the ignobility of their descent, and that they were every one chosen by him for their beauty, but not for their family. Now those wives of his were not a few, it being of old permitted to the Jews to marry many wives, and this king delighting in many, all which hated Alexander, on account of Glaphyra's boasting and reproaches. Nay, Aristobulus had raised a quarrel between himself and Salome, who was his mother-in-law, and besides the anger he had conceived at Glaphyra's reproaches, for he perpetually upbraided his wife with the meanness of her family, and complained that, as he had married a woman of a low family, so had his brother Alexander married one of royal blood. At this, Salome's daughter wept, and told it her with this addition, that Alexander threatened the mothers of his own brethren, that when he should come to the crown, he would make them weave with their maidens, and would make those brothers of his country schoolmasters, and break this jest upon them, that they had been very carefully instructed to fit them for such an employment. Hereupon Salome could not contain her anger, but told all to Herod, nor could her testimony be suspected, since it was against her own son-in-law. There was also another calumny, which ran abroad and inflamed the king's mind, for he had heard that these sons of his were perpetually speaking to their mother, and among their lamentations for her did not abstain from cursing him, and that, when he made presents of any of Mariamne's garments to his later wives, these threatened that in no little time, instead of royal garments, they would close theft in no better than haircloth. Now, upon these accounts, though Herod was somewhat afraid of a young man's high spirit, yet he did not despair of reducing them to a much better mind. But before he went to Rome, whither he was now going by sea, he called them to him, and partly threatened them a little, as a king, but for the main he admonished them as a father, and exhorted them to love their brethren, and told them that he would pardon their former offences, if they would amend for the time to come. But they refuted the calumnies that had been raised to them, and said that they were false, and alleged that their actions were sufficient for their vindication, and said withal that he himself ought to shut his ears against such tales, and would not be too easy in believing them, for that there would never be wanting those who would tell lies to their disadvantage, as long as any would give ear to them. When they had thus pacified him, as being their father, they got clear of the present fear that they were in, yet did they see occasion for sorrow in some time afterward, for they knew that Salome, as well as their uncle Pheroras, were their enemies, who were both of them heavy and severe persons, and especially Pheroras, who was a partner with Herod in all the affairs of the kingdom, excepting the diadem. He had also 100 talents of his own revenue, and enjoyed the advantage of all the land beyond the Jordan. Nay, Pheroras had been accused long before, while the queen, Mariamne, was alive, as if he were in a plot to poison Herod. And there came then so great a number of informers that Herod himself, though he was an exceeding lover of his brethren, was brought to believe what they said, and to be afraid of it also. And when he had brought many of those who were under suspicion to the torture, he came at last to Pheroras' own friends, none of whom did openly confess the crime, but they owned that he had made preparations to take her whom he loved and run away to the Parthians. Costobarus, too, the husband of Salome, to whom the king had given her in marriage, after her former husband had been put to death for adultery, was instrumental in bringing about this contrivance and flight of his. Nor did Salome escape all calumny upon herself, for her brother Pheroras accused her that she had made an agreement to marry Seleus, the procurator of Obodas, the king of Arabia, who was at bitter enmity with Herod. But when she was convicted of this, and all that Pheroras had accused her of, she obtained her pardon. The king also pardoned Pheroras himself the crimes he had been accused of. But the storm of the whole family was removed to Alexander, and all of it rested upon his head. There were 3 eunuchs who were in the highest esteem with the king, as was plain by the offices they were in about him. For one of them was appointed to be his butler. Another of them got his supper ready for him, and the third put him into bed, and lay down by him. Now Alexander had prevailed with these men, by large gifts, to let him use them after an obscene manner, which, when it was told to the king, they were tortured and found guilty, and presently confessed the criminal conversation he had with them. They also discovered the promises by which they were induced to do so, and how they were deluded by Alexander, who had told them that they ought not to fix their hopes upon Herod, an old man, and one so shameless as to color his hair, unless they thought they would make him young again, but that they ought to fix their attention to him who was to be his successor in the kingdom, whether he would or not, and who in no time would advantage himself on his enemies, and make his friends happy and blessed, and themselves in the first place. That the men of power did already pay respects to Alexander, privately, and that the captains of the soldiery and the officers did secretly come to him. These confessions did so terrify Herod, that he durst not immediately publish them, but he sent spies abroad privately, by day and by night, who should make a close inquiry after all that was done and said, and when any were but suspected of treason, he put them to death, insomuch that the palace was full of horribly unjust proceedings, for everybody forged calumnies, as they were themselves in a state of enmity or hatred against others. And many there were who abused the king's bloody passion to the disadvantage of those with whom they had quarrels, and lies were easily believed, and punishments were inflicted sooner than the calumnies were forged. He who had just then been accusing another was accused himself, and was led away to execution together with him whom he had convicted. For the danger the king was in of his life made examinations be very short. He also proceeded to such a degree of bitterness that he could not look on any of those who were not accused with a pleasant countenance, but was in the most barbarous disposition towards his own friends. Accordingly, he forbade a great many of them to come to court, and to those whom he had not the power to punish actually, he spake harshly. But for Antipater, he insulted Alexander. Now he was under his misfortunes, and got a stout company of his kindred together, and raised all sorts of calumny against him. And for the king, he was brought to such a degree of terror by these prodigious slanders and contrivances, that he fancied he saw Alexander coming to him with a drawn sword in his hand. So he caused him to be seized upon immediately, and bound, and fell to examining his friends by torture, many of whom died under the torture, but would discover nothing. nor say anything against their consciences. But some of them, being forced to speak falsely by the pains they endured, said that Alexander and his brother Aristobulus plotted against him, and waited for an opportunity to kill him as he was hunting, and then fly away to Rome. These accusations, though they were of an incredible nature, and only framed upon the great distress that they were in, were readily believed by the king, who thought it some comfort to him, after he had bound his son, that it might appear he had not done it unjustly. End of Book 1, Chapters 23 and 24. Book 1, Chapters 25 and 26 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Wars of the Jews by Josephus, translated by William Whiston. Book 1, Chapters 25 and 26. Chapter 25. Archelaus procures a reconciliation between Alexander, Pheroras, and Herod. Now, as to Alexander, since he perceived it impossible to persuade his father that he was innocent, he resolved to meet his calamities, however severe soever they were. So he composed 4 books against his enemies, and confessed that he had been in a plot, but declared withal that the greatest part of the courtiers were in a plot with him, and chiefly Pheroras and Salome, nay, that Salome once came and forced him to lie with her in the night-time, whether he would or no. These books were put into Herod's hands, and made a great clamor against the men in power. And now it was that Archelaus came hastily into Judea, being affrighted for his son-in-law and his daughter, and he came as a proper assistant, and in a very prudent manner, and by a stratagem he obliged the king not to execute what he had threatened. For when he was come to him, he cried out, "Where in the world is this wretched son-in-law of mine? Where shall I see the head of him which contrived to murder his father, which I will tear to pieces with my own hands? I will do the same also to my daughter, who hath such a fine husband. For although she be not a partner in the plot, yet by being the wife of such a creature, she is polluted. And I cannot but admire at thy patience, against whom this plot is laid, if Alexander be still alive, for as I come with what haste I could from Cappadocia, I expected to find him put to death for his crimes long ago. But still, in order to make an examination of thee about my daughter, whom, out of regard to thee and by dignity, I had espoused to him in marriage, but now we must take counsel about them both. And if thy paternal affection be so great that thou cannot punish thy son, who hath plotted against thee, let us change our right hands, and let us succeed to the other in expressing our rage upon this occasion." When he had made this pompous declaration, he got Herod to remit of his anger, though he were in disorder, who thereupon gave him the books which Alexander had composed to be read by him. And as he came to every head, he considered of it, together with Herod. So Archelaus took hence the occasion for that stratagem which he made use of, and by degrees he laid the blame on those men whose names were in those books, and especially upon Pheroras. And when he saw that the king believed him to be in earnest, he said, "We must consider whether the young man be not himself plotted against by such a number of wicked wretches, and not thou plotted against by the young man. For I cannot see any occasion for his falling into so horrid a crime, since he enjoys the advantages of royalty already, and has the expectation of being one of thy successors. I mean this, unless there were some persons that persuade him to it, and such persons as make an ill use of the faculty they know there is to persuade young men. For by such persons not only young men are sometimes imposed upon, but old men also, and by them sometimes are the most illustrious families and kingdoms overturned." Herod assented to what he had said, and by degrees abated of his anger against Alexander, but was more angry at Pheroras, for the principal subject of the 4 books was Pheroras, who, perceiving that the king's inclinations changed on a sudden, and that Archelaus's friendship could do everything with him, and that he had no honorable method of preserving himself, he procured his safety by his impudence. So he left Alexander and had recourse to Archelaus, who told him that he did not see how he could get him excused, now that he was directly caught in so many crimes, whereby it was evidently demonstrated that he had plotted against the king, and had been the cause of those misfortunes which the young man was now under, unless he could moreover leave off his cunning knavery, and his denials of what he was charged withal, and confess the charge, and implore pardon of his brother, who still had a kindness for him, but that, if he would do so, he would afford him all the assistance he was able. With this advice, Pheroras complied, and, putting himself into such a habit as might most move compassion, he came with black cloth upon his body, and tears in his eyes, and threw himself down at Herod's feet, and begged his pardon for what he had done, and confessed that he had acted very wickedly, and was guilty of everything that he had been accused of, and lamented that disorder of his mind and distraction which his love to a woman, he said, had brought him to. So, when Archelaus had brought Pheroras to accuse and bear witness against himself, he then made an excuse for him, and mitigated Herod's anger towards him, and this by using certain domestical examples, for that, when he had suffered much greater mischief from a brother of his own, he preferred the obligations of nature before the passion of revenge, because it is in kingdoms, as it is in gross bodies, where some member or other is ever swelled by the body's weight, in which case it is not proper to cut off such member, but to heal it by a gentle method of cure. Upon Archelaus saying this, and much more to the same purpose, Herod's displeasure against Pheroras was mollified. Yet he did persevere in his own indignation against Alexander, and said that he would have his daughter divorced, and taken away from him, and this till he had brought Herod to that pass, that, contrary to his former behavior to him, he petitioned Archelaus for the young man, and that he would let his daughter continue espoused to him. But Archelaus made him strongly believe that he would permit her to be married to any one else, but not to Alexander, because he looked upon it as a very valuable advantage that the revelation they had contracted by that affinity, and the privileges that went along with it, might be preserved. And when the king said that his son would take it for a great favor to him, if he would not dissolve that marriage, especially since they had already children between the young man and her, and since that wife of his was so well beloved by him, and that as while she remains his wife she would be a great preservative to him, and keep him from offending, as he had formerly done, so if she should be once torn away from him, she would be the cause of his falling into despair, because such young man's attempts are best mollified when they are diverted from them by settling their affections at home. So Archelaus complied with what Herod desired, but not without difficulty, and was both himself reconciled to the young man, and reconciled his father to him also. However, he said he must, by all means, be sent to Rome to discourse with Caesar, because he had already written a full account to him of this whole matter. Thus a period was put to Archelaus's stratagem, whereby he delivered his son-in-law out of the dangers he was in, but when these reconciliations were over, they spent their time in feastings and agreeable entertainments. And when Archelaus was going away, Herod made him a present of 70 talents, with a golden throne set with precious stones, and some eunuchs, and a concubine who was called Panicus. He also paid due honors to every one of his friends according to their dignity. In like manner did all the king's kindred, by his command, make glorious presents to Archelaus. And, as he was conducted on his way by Herod and his nobility, as far as Antioch. Chapter 26. How Eurycles calumniated the sons of Mariamne, and how Euaratus of Cos's apology for them had no effect. Now, a little time afterward, there came into Judea a man that was much superior to Archelaus's stratagems, who did not only overturn that reconciliation that had been so wisely made with Alexander, but proved the occasion of his ruin. He was a Lacedaemonian, and his name was Eurycles. [Footnote: This vile fellow, Eurycles the Lacedaemonian, seems to have been the same who is mentioned by Plutarch as, 25 years before, a companion to Mark Antony, and as living with Herod, whence he might easily insinuate himself into the acquaintance of Herod's sons, Antipater and Alexander, as Usher, Hudson, and Spanheim justly suppose. The reason why his being a Spartan rendered him acceptable to the Jews, as we here see he was, is visible from the public records of the Jews and Spartans, owning those Spartans to be the kin to the Jews, and deriving from their common ancestor Abraham, the first patriarch of the Jewish nation. End footnote. He was so corrupt a man that, out of the desire of getting money, he chose to live under a king, for Greece could not suffice his luxury. He presented Herod with splendid gifts, as a bait, which he laid in order to compass his ends, and quickly received them back again manifold. Yet did he esteem bare gifts as nothing, unless he imbrued the kingdom in blood by his purchases. Accordingly he imposed upon the king by flattering him, and by talking subtly to him, and also by the lying encomiums which he made upon him. For he soon perceived Herod's blind side, as he said and did everything that might please him, and thereby became one of his most intimate friends. For both the king and all that were about him had a great regard for this Spartan, on account of his country. Now, as soon as this fellow perceived the rotten parts of the family, and what quarrels the brothers had with one another, and in what disposition the father was towards each of them, he chose to take his lodgings at first in the house of Antipater, but deluded Alexander but with a pretense of friendship to him, and falsely claimed to be an old acquaintance of Archelaus, for which reason he was presently admitted into Alexander's familiarity as a faithful friend. He also soon recommended himself to his brother Aristobulus, and when he had thus made trial of these several persons, he imposed upon one of them by one method, and upon another by another. But he was principally hired by Antipater, and so betrayed Alexander, and this by reproaching Antipater, because, while he was the eldest son, he overlooked the intrigues of those who stood in the way of his expectations, and by reproaching Alexander, because he was born of a queen, and was married to a king's daughter, permitted one that was born of a mean woman to lay claim to the succession, and this when he had Archelaus to support him in the most complete manner. Nor was his advice thought to be other than faithful by the young man, because of the pretended friendship with Archelaus, on which account it was that Alexander lamented to him Antipater's behavior in regard to himself, and this without concealing anything from him. And how it was no wonder if Herod, after he had killed their mother, should deprive them of her kingdom. Upon this, Eurycles pretended to commiserate his condition, and to grieve with him. He also, by a bait that he had laid for him, procured Aristobulus to say the same things. Thus did he inveigle between the two brothers to make complaints of their father, and then went to Antipater and carried these grand secrets to him. He also added a fiction of his own, as if his brothers had laid a plot against him, and were almost ready to come upon him with their drawn swords. For this intelligence he received a great sum of money, and on that account he commended Antipater before his father, and at length undertook the work of bringing Alexander and Aristobulus to their graves, and accused them before their father. So he came to Herod, and told him that he would save his life, as a requital for the favors he had received from him, and he would preserve his light of life by way of retribution for his kind entertainment. For that sword had long been whetted, and Alexander's right hand had long stretched out against him, but that he had laid impediments in his way, prevented his speed, and that, by pretending to assist him in his design, how Alexander said that Herod was not contented to reign in a kingdom that belonged to others, and to make dilapidations in their mother's government after he had killed her. And besides all this, that he had introduced a spurious successor, and proposed to give the kingdom of their ancestors to that pestilent fellow Antipater, and that he would now appease the ghosts of Hyrcanus and Mariamne by taking vengeance on him. for that it was not fit for him to take succession to the government from such a father without bloodshed, that many things happen every day to provoke him to do so, insomuch that he can say nothing at all, but it affords occasion for calumny against him, for that if any mention be made of nobility of birth, even in other cases, he is abused unjustly, while his father would say that nobody, to be sure, is of noble birth but Alexander, and that his father was inglorious for want of such nobility. If there be at any time hunting, he says nothing. He gives offense, and if he commands anybody, they take it in way of jest. They also find their father unmercifully severe, and they have no natural affection for any of them but for Antipater, on which accounts, if this plot does not take, he is very willing to die, but that, in case he kills his father, he hath sufficient opportunities for saving himself. In the first place, he hath Archelaus, his father-in-law, to whom he can easily fly, and in the next place, he hath Caesar, who had never known Herod's character to this day, for that he shall not appear then before him with that dread he used to do when his father was there to terrify him, and that he will not then produce the accusations that concerned himself alone, but would in the first place openly insist on the calamities of their nation, and how they are taxed to death, and in what ways of luxury and wicked practices that wealth is spent which was gotten by bloodshed. What sort of persons they are that get our riches, and to whom those cities belong, upon whom he bestows his favors, that he would have inquiry made what became of his grandfather Hyrcanus, and of his mother Mariamne, and would openly proclaim the gross wickedness that was in the kingdom, on which accounts he should not be deemed a parricide. When Eurycles had made this portentous speech, he greatly commended Antipater, as the only child that had an affection for his father, and on that account was an impediment to the other's plot against him. Hereupon the king, who had hardly repressed his anger upon the former accusations, was exasperated to an incurable degree, at which time Antipater took another occasion to send in other persons to his father, to accuse his brethren, and to tell him that they had privately discoursed with Jucundus and Tyrannus, who had been masters of the horse to the king, but for some offences had been put out of that honourable employment. Herod was in a very great rage at these informations, and presently ordered those men to be tortured. Yet did not they confess anything of what the king had been informed. But a certain letter was produced, as written by Alexander to the governor of a castle, to desire him to receive him and Aristobulus into the castle, when he had killed his father, and to give them weapons, and what other assistance he could, upon that occasion. Alexander said that this letter was a forgery of Diophantus. This Diophantus was the king's secretary, a bold man, and cunning in counterfeiting anyone's hand, and after he had counterfeited a great number, he was at last put to death for it. Herod did also order the governor of the castle to be tortured, but got nothing out of him of what the accusation suggested. However, although Herod found the proofs too weak, he gave order to keep his sons kept in custody, for till now they had been at liberty. He also called that pest of his family, and forger of all this vile accusation, Eurycles, his saviour and benefactor, and gave him a reward of 50 talents, upon which he prevented any accurate accounts that could come of what he had done, by going immediately into Cappadocia, and there he got money of Archelaus, having the impudence to pretend that he had reconciled Herod to Alexander. He thence passed over into Greece, and used what he had thus wickedly gotten to the like wicked purposes. Accordingly, he was twice accused before Caesar, that he had filled Achaia with sedition, and had plundered its cities, and so he was sent into banishment. And thus he was punished for that wicked actions he had been guilty of about Aristobulus and Alexander. But it will be worth while to put Euaratus of Cos in opposition to this Spartan, for, as he was one of Alexander's most intimate friends, and came to him in his travels at the same time that Eurycles came, so that the king put the question to him, whether those things of which Alexander was accused were true. He assured him upon oath that he had never heard any such things from the young men. Nor did this testimony avail nothing for the clearing of those miserable creatures. For Herod was only disposed and most ready to hearken to what made against them, and every one was most agreeable to him that would believe they were guilty, and showed their indignation at them. End of Book 1, Chapters 25 and 26. Book 1, Chapters 27 and 28 of The Wars of the Jews. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Wars of the Jews by Josephus. Translated by William Whiston. Book 1, Chapters 27 and 28. Chapters 27. Herod, by Caesar's direction, accuses his sons at Euritus. They are not produced before the courts, but yet are condemned. And in a little time they are sent to Sebaste and strangled there. Moreover, Salome exasperated Herod's cruelty against his sons, for Aristobulus was desirous to bring her, who was his mother-in-law and his aunt, into the like dangers with themselves. So he sent to her to take care of her own safety, and told her that the king was preparing to put her to death, on account of the accusation that was laid against her, as if, when she formerly endeavored to marry herself to Salius, the Arabian, she had discovered the king's grand secrets to him, who was the king's enemy, and this it was that came as the last storm, and entirely sunk the young men when they were in great danger before. For Salome came running to the king, and informed him of what admonition had been given her, whereupon he could bear no longer, but commanded both the young men to be bound, and kept the one asunder from the other. He also sent Volumnius, the general of his army, to Caesar immediately, as also his friend Olympus with him, who carried the informations in writing along with them. Now, as soon as they had sailed to Rome, and delivered the king's letters to Caesar, Caesar was mightily troubled at the case of the young men. Yet he did not think he ought to take power from the father of condemning his sons. So he wrote back to him, and appointed him to have the power over his sons, but said withal that he would do well to make an examination into this matter of the plot against him in a public court, and to take for his successors his own kindred, and the governors of the province. If those sons be found guilty, to put them to death. But if they appear to have thought of no more than flying away from him, that he should moderate their punishment. With these directions Herod complied, and came to Berytus, where Caesar had ordered the court to be assembled, and got the judicature together. The president sat first, as Caesar's letters had appointed, who were Saturninus and Pedanius, and their lieutenants that were with them, with whom was the procurator Volumnius also. Next to them sat the king's kinsmen and friends, with Salome also, and Pheroras, after whom sat the principal men of all Syria, excepting Archelaus, for Herod had a suspicion of him, because he was Alexander's father-in-law. Yet he did not produce his sons in open court, and this was done very cunningly, for he knew well enough that had they but appeared only, they would certainly have been pitied, and if withal they were suffered to speak, Alexander could have easily answered what they were accused of. But they were in custody at Platane, a village of the Sidontans. So the king got up and inveighed against his sons, as if they were present, and as for that part of the accusation that they had plotted against him, he urged it but faintly, because he was destitute of proofs. But he insisted before the assessors on their reproaches and jests and injurious carriage, and 10,000 the like offences against him, which were heavier than death itself. And when nobody contradicted him, he moved them to pity his case, as though he had been condemned himself. Now he had gained a bitter victory against his sons. So he asked every one's sentence, which sentence was first of all given by Saturninus, and was this, that he condemned the young men, but not to death, for that was not fit for them, who had three sons of his own now present, to give his vote for the destruction of the sons of another. The two lieutenants also gave the like vote, and some others there were also who followed their example. But Volumnius began to vote on the more melancholy side, and all those that came after him condemned the young men to die, some out of flattery, and some out of hatred to Herod, but none out of indignation at their crimes. And now all Syria and Judea was in great expectation, and waited for the last act of this tragedy. Yet did nobody suppose that Herod would be so barbarous as to murder his children. However, he carried them away to Tyre, and thence sailed to Caesarea, and deliberated with himself what sort of death the young men should suffer. Now there was a certain old soldier of the king's, whose name was Tero, who had a son that was very familiar with and a friend to Alexander, and who himself particularly loved the young men. This soldier was in a manner distracted out of the excess of the indignation he had at what he was doing, and at first he cried out aloud, as he went about, that justice was trampled underfoot, that truth was perished, and nature confounded, and that the life of man was full of iniquity, and everything else that passion could suggest to a man who had spared not his own life. And at last he ventured to go to the king and said, "Truly, I think thou art a most miserable man when thou hearkenest to the most wicked wretches against those that ought to be the dearest to thee, since thou hast frequently resolved that Pheroras and Salome should be put to death, and yet believest them against thy sons, while these, by cutting off the succession of thine own sons, leave all wholly to Antipater, and thereby choose to have thee such a king as may be thoroughly in their own power. However, consider whether this death of Antipater's brethren will not make him hated by the soldiers, for there is nobody but commiserates the young men, and of the captains a great many show their indignation at it openly." Upon his saying this, he named those that had such indignation. But the king ordered those men, with Tero himself and his son, to be seized upon immediately. At which time there was a certain barber, whose name was Trypho. This man leaped out from among the people in a kind of madness, and accused himself, saying, "This Tero endeavored to persuade me also to cut thy throat with my razor, when I trimmed thee, and promised that Alexander should give me large presents for so doing." When Herod heard this, he examined Tero, with his son and the barber, by the torture. But as the others denied the accusation, he said nothing further. Herod gave order that Tero should be racked most severely, but his son, out of pity to his father, promised to discover the whole to the king, if he would grant that his father should no longer be tortured. When he had agreed to this, he said that his father, at the persuasion of Alexander, had an intention to kill him. Now some said this was forged, in order to free his father from his torments, and some said that it was true. And now Herod accused the captains and Tero in an assembly of the people, and he brought the people together in a body against them. And accordingly they were put to death, together with Trypho the barber. They were killed by the pieces of wood and stones that were thrown at them. He also sent his sons to Sebaste, a city not far from Caesarea, and ordered them there strangled. And as what he had ordered was executed immediately, so he commanded that their dead bodies should be brought to the fortress Alexandrium, to be buried with Alexander, their grandfather, by the mother's side. And this was the end of Alexander and Aristobulus. Chapter 28. How Antipater is hated of all men, and how the king espouses the sons of those who had been slain to his kindred, but that Antipater made him change them for other women. Of Herod's marriages and children. But an intolerable hatred fell upon Antipater from the nation, though he had now an indisputable title to the succession, because they all knew that he was the person who contrived all the calumnies against his brethren. However, he began to be in a terrible fear, as he saw the posterity of those who had been slain growing up. For Alexander had two sons by Glaphyra, Tigranes and Alexander, and Aristobulus had Herod and Agrippa, and Aristobulus his sons, with Herodias and Mariamne, his daughters, and all by Bernice, Salome's daughter. As for Glaphyra, Herod, as soon as he had killed Alexander, sent her back, together with her portion to Cappadocia. He married Bernice, Aristobulus's daughter, to Antipater's uncle by his mother. And it was Antipater who, in order to reconcile her to him, when she had been at variance with him, contrived this match. He also got into Pheroras's favor, and into the favor of Caesar's friends, by presents, and other ways of obsequiousness, and sent no small sums of money to Rome. Saturninus also, and his friends in Syria, were all well replenished with the presents he made them. Yet the more he gave, the more he was hated, as not making these presents out of generosity, but spending his money out of fear. Accordingly, it so fell out that the receivers bore him no more good will than before, but that those to whom he gave nothing were his more bitter enemies. However, he bestowed his money every day more and more profusely, on observing that, contrary to his expectations, the king was taking care about the orphans, and discovering at the same time his repentance for killing their fathers, by his commiseration of those that sprang from them. Accordingly, Herod got together his kindred and friends, and set before them the children, and, with his eyes full of tears, said thus to them, "It was an unlucky fate that took away from me these children's fathers, which children are recommended to me by their natural commiseration, which their orphan condition requires. However, I will endeavor, though I have been a most unfortunate father, to appear a better grandfather, and to leave these children such curators after myself as are dearest to me. I therefore betroth thy daughter, Pheroras, to the elder of these brethren, the children of Alexander, that thou mayest be obliged to take care of them. I also betroth thy son, Antipater, to the daughter of Aristobulus. Be thou therefore a father to that orphan. And my son, Herod, Philip, shall have her sister, whose grandfather, by the mother's side, was high priest. And let every one that loves me be of my sentiments in these dispositions, which none that hath an affection for me will abrogate. And I pray God that he will join these children together in marriage to the advantage of my kingdom and of my posterity, and may he look down with eyes more serene upon them than he looked upon their fathers." While he spake these words, he wept, and joined the children's right hands together. After which he embraced them, every one after an affectionate manner, and dismissed the assembly. Upon this, Antipater was in great disorder immediately, and lamented publicly at what was done, for he supposed that his dignity, which was conferred on these orphans, was for his own destruction, even in his father's lifetime, and that he should run another risk of losing the government, if Alexander's son should have both Archelaus, a king, and Pheroras, a tetrarch, to support them. He also considered how he was himself hated by the nation, and how they pitied these orphans, how great affection the Jews bare to those brethren of his when they were alive, and how gladly they remembered them now that they had perished by his means. So he resolved by all the ways possible to get these espousals dissolved. Now he was afraid of going subtly about the matter with his father, who was hard to be pleased, and was presently moved upon the least suspicion. So he ventured to go to him directly, and to beg of him before his face not to deprive him of that dignity which he had been pleased to bestow upon him, and that he might not have the bare name of a king while the power was in another person's, for that he should never be able to keep the government if Alexander's son was to have both his grandfather Archelaus and Pheroras for his curators. And he besought him earnestly, since there was so many of the royal family alive, that he would change those intended marriages. Now the king had 9 wives. Footnote. Dean Aldrich takes notice here that these 9 wives of Herod were alive at the same time, and that if the celebrated Mariamne, who was now dead, be reckoned, those wives were in all 10. Yet it is remarkable that he had no more than 15 children by them all. End footnote. And children by 7 of them. Antipater was himself born of Doris, and Herod Philip of Mariamne, the high priest's daughter. Antipas also, and Archelaus, were by Malthasae, the Samaritan, as was his daughter Olympias, which his brother Joseph's son had married. [Footnote: To prevent confusion, it may not be amiss, with Dean Aldrich, to distinguish between the four Josephs in the history of Herod. 1. Joseph, Herod's uncle, and the second husband of his sister Salome, slain by Herod on account of a Mariamne. 2. Joseph, Herod's quaestor, or treasurer, slain on the same account. 3. Joseph, Herod's brother, slain in battle against Antigonus. 4. Joseph, Herod's nephew, the husband of Olympias, mentioned in this place. End footnote. By Cleopatra of Jerusalem, he had Herod and Philip. By Pallas, Pharsalius. He had also two daughters, Roxana and Salome, the one by Phaedra, the other by Elpis. He had also two wives that had no children, the one his first cousin, and the other his niece. And besides these, he had two daughters, the sisters of Alexander and Aristobulus by Mariamne. Since, therefore, the royal family was so numerous, Antipater prayed him to change these intended marriages. When the king perceived what disposition he was in towards these orphans, he was angry at it, and a suspicion came into his mind as to those sons whom he had put to death, whether they had not been brought about by the false tales of Antipater. And so at that time he made Antipater a long and peevish answer, and bid him begone. Yet he was afterwards prevailed upon cunningly by his flatteries, and changed the marriages. He married Aristobulus's daughter to him, and his son to Pheroras's daughter. Now one may learn, in this instance, how very much this flattering Antipater could do, even what Salome in the like circumstances could not do. For when she, who was his sister, and who, by the means of Julia, Caesar's wife, earnestly desired leave to be married to Silius the Arabian, Herod swore that he would esteem her his bitter enemy, unless she would leave off that project. He also caused her, against her own consent, to be married to Alexis, a friend of his, and that one of her daughters should be married to Alexis's son, and the other to Antipater's uncle by the mother's side. And for the daughters the king had by Mariamne, the one was married to Antipater, his sister's son, and the other to his brother's son, Phasaelus. End of Book 1, Chapters 27 and 28.